All right. Thank you, Carmelita. Our next speakers are Gil Zemanski and Jennifer Rose. Gil is registered as a groundwater hydrologist by the American Institute of Hydrology. He's certified as a groundwater professional by the National Groundwater Association. He has more than 45 years of professional education and experience, primarily as a hydrologist. He currently works as a research analyst for Shue, Carty, and Bacon LLC in Kansas City, Missouri, teaching lawyers hydrogeology. He worked as a technical supervisor in a Crown Research Institute and as an independent consultant for 9 years in New Zealand. Jennifer began her career as a hydrogeologist in New Zealand, where she worked at a multidisciplinary consulting firm and at one of New Zealand's Crown Research Institutes, I believe, with Gil, for 6 years. She joined the Minnesota DNR 5 years ago, where her role is to provide expert technical analysis on the nature, availability, and use of groundwater in northwestern Minnesota. Welcome, Gil and Jennifer, and I'll just take a minute to pull up the presentation here.
I'm glad that Ellen introduced us like that, because some colleagues of mine today are going, are we reaching out to New Zealand now? Was DNR working in New Zealand? I said, no, I used to work there, so I'm going to speak on that today. So we're just going to give a brief, I'm going to give a brief overview of New Zealand and the hydrogeology and the ground, the geology. And Gil's going to walk you through how New Zealand has historically and currently manages groundwater, some of the issues that they're facing today, and changes that are underway right now. And he's going to give a technical example of what science is being done to tackle these issues. And it's going to be, it's a technical fail, but it may be overall successful for the resource in the end. And we're going to end on a comparison of New Zealand and the U.S. in overall groundwater management. So out of curiosity, how many of you actually been to New Zealand? Anyone here? Oh, great. Yay. So now you get to look at some more pretty pictures of where you were. So it is about 8,000 nautical miles southwest of where we're at. It takes about 12 hours to fly there from California. So it's a 12-hour flight from California to New Zealand. They're at about a latitude ranges from 35 to 46. And so up on 35, it's almost subtropical, and down towards the bottom of the country, they get blizzards. And just for reference, we're at about 44 north, to put that in your mind. And they are a day ahead in time of us, so they're already on to tomorrow. And so they're 19 hours ahead of us. New Zealand, they became a British colony in 1840 after the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi in 1840 with a... And that was signed by a representative of Queen Victoria and about 540 Maori chiefs. So the Maori people are their native people. It later became a member of the British Commonwealth of Nations and is considered a constitutional monarchy, but has no single constitutional document. It's the sum of all the laws and the principles of New Zealand that governs them, including the Treaty of Waitangi. Queen Elizabeth II is the head of the state and is represented in New Zealand by a governor general. So in practice, New Zealand's central and local government run the country. It has three branches of government, just like the U.S. has, but their executive branch is headed by a prime minister, who is currently Jacinda Ardern, and their legislative branch is a unicameral parliament. There are a number of political parties in New Zealand. There are about five right now that hold seats in their parliament. And they have two major parties, the Labour Party, which is their more liberal party like the Democrats here, and the National Party, which is conservative like the Republicans here. So New Zealand and Minnesota, they are of similar size and population. New Zealand's a bit bigger and has a little smaller population, but their geography and their climate are obviously quite different. New Zealand climate is considered maritime with a temperate temperature range, and the ocean, prevailing winds, and mountains greatly influence their climate. The west side of New Zealand receives most of the precipitation, especially on the South Island. They can get between 2 and 10 meters of precip, so snow and rainfall. And on the east side is much drier, getting about a half a meter to 1 meter. The majority of the terrain is considered relatively steep hill or mountainous. The South Island is often described as mountains and rivers, and the North Island as hills and streams. New Zealand also governs the Chatham Islands, located to the southeast, the Kermadec Islands to the northeast, and Stewart Island, just off the tip of the South Island there. New Zealand is located on a boundary of the Australian and Pacific plates, which give rise to rapid rates of uplift, subsidence, erosion, and deposition. And this active tectonic environment also hosts volcanoes and geothermal activity, and earthquakes occur across the entire country. This is the Kermadec Islands you can see that are part of the active volcanic chain. And this is the Central North Island volcanoes, or stratovolcanoes, with andesite cones. And this was the view that Gil and I had from the town we lived in, so it's quite pretty. Geothermal areas in New Zealand, they also bring in over 1 million tourists each year and are economically valuable, as geothermal steam is used to generate electricity. Mountains on the North and South Island are predominantly greywacke of Mesozoic age, and the Southern Alps, they traverse the entire length of the South Island, and they have active glaciers found on the west coast of the South Island, and as you can see in these photos, are being impacted by climate change. You can see how in 2009 the glacier was further down the valley. Glacial activity has also shaped the landscape in New Zealand. For instance, the Canterbury Plains are built from glacial outwash. And there are also karst systems in New Zealand, so they and that continue for many kilometers, and are also popular with the tourists as they do black water rafting through the caves. Aquifers, they exist in a wide range of lithologies in New Zealand, and they yield both hot and cold water. Most of the aquifers are in geologically young sediments and in volcanic deposits. There is very little information on the geology and hydrogeology of New Zealand aquifers, particularly the hydraulic properties such as conductivity, saturated thickness, and porosity. And porous soils of volcanic origin can result in high values of groundwater recharge on the order of 50%. And the greywacke rock that predominate the New Zealand mountains, they're not favorable for aquifers. And you can see on this map, there are about 200 identified aquifers in New Zealand, as seen on the in blue. And that covers about 26% of the land area. New Zealand aquifers, they are typically small compared to the U.S., like the Ogallala Aquifer that underlies part of 8 states and is almost twice the size of the entire country. However, the aquifer sizes may be more comparable to those in Minnesota. At least some of our groundwater management areas, like Bonanza Valley, is about 1,800 square kilometers in size. New Zealand has a national groundwater monitoring program that's run by the Institute of Geological and Nuclear Sciences, where Gil and I worked. And this network is also augmented by about 853 sites monitored by local regional councils. So in total, they have about 970 sites. And to compare that to Minnesota, in our DNR observation well network, we have about 1,070 wells in our network, with about 650 wells with continuous monitoring. You can see that about a third of New Zealand's monitoring wells are in the Canterbury area, and that's where you can see Christchurch written there, which has a database of wells of over 4,000. And that contrasts to some of the areas in New Zealand that does not have a wells database, and that makes it hard to do hydrogeology without a wells database. The monitoring network has few wells that are purpose-built for monitoring, so they're old farm wells, maybe don't have a well log. They're primarily in unconfined aquifers and are about a median depth of 75 feet. They do water quality sampling on a quarterly basis, and they monitor for pesticides on a 4-yearly interval. Under New Zealand common law, naturally flowing freshwater is not owned by anybody, but is treated as a public good, with certain Maori exceptions. Water allocation in New Zealand are on a first-come and first-served basis, similar to our Western water law here. Resource consents are required to take water from local councils, and so this map shows where all the consents for freshwater, so it's both groundwater and surface water. But you can see that the majority of the consents are for irrigation, so the blue dots, and you can especially see that in the Canterbury area, where they have about 12% of the nation water resources, but 50% of the irrigated area of New Zealand nationally. While they do have a lot of groundwater consents, they do use more fresh water than, or surface water than groundwater. So they only use about 30% of the groundwater by volume. And just to give you an idea, so they're, unlike Minnesota that predominantly irrigates row crops, they're irrigating pasture there for dairy production and for sheep and beef. I'll hand that over to Gil.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the history and the current groundwater groundwater management system in New Zealand. New Zealand's first law that affected water was passed in 1941. The objective of that law was flood and erosion control of surface waters. It had nothing to do beyond that with groundwater. One thing it did establish that's continued on to this day are catchment boards that have the general, you know, ultimately became what we now have in New Zealand as regional councils set up on surface water basins. After a review of what was happening by the 1960s, they passed a new law replacing the old one. And again, that addressed primarily surface waters. That was its focus. It changed the catchment board titles to regional water boards. And it did explicitly address groundwater in the requirement that groundwater takes for groundwater use would have to be permitted. This shows you the North and South Island boundaries for the catchment boards originally and what we have now for the regional boards. There are 16 regional boards that manage groundwater and other environmental matters in New Zealand. There are 7 on the South Island and 9 on the North Island. The status of groundwater regulation in New Zealand was comprehensively reviewed again in 1981. The recommendations from that review included increased central government science center. They had a science center that served the whole country. And regional water board staffing, equipment, and funding. It was, you know, they had problems in all areas, basically. Also, training for regional water board staff in fundamentals of groundwater. Most of the staff were people that were hired and learned on the job without a background in groundwater. And then having, they requested that the law required the regional water boards to establish a permit system for drilling wells, and the intent on that was to have logs made of the drilling that would provide hydraulic and geologic data to the regional water board so they'd have more data to be able to do a rational job of management with. Despite that recommendation at that time, 40 years later, some of the regional water boards are now, regional councils still were not requiring that drilling logs be submitted when a well was drilled. What we have now is the Resource Management Act. It was passed in 1991 after a wholesale of New Zealand environmental laws that occurred in the 1980s. The intent was to get one law that would address all environmental matters, land, air, and water in one statute, and with the objective of sustainable management of all resources at the same time. The clear focus of the RMA was, again, surface waters. And in fact, although surface waters are mentioned in the RMA, groundwater itself, that term is not used. Groundwater is only incorporated by broad definitions, such as, you know, all waters include, you know, all waters within in New Zealand are regulated by it, and that includes groundwater, even though they don't say groundwater. The RMA also recognized the special relationship of Maori in New Zealand to fresh waters culturally and historically, some of which was also in the Treaty of Waitangi. This is a diagram of how the RMA was set up. It's there are some blocks that are crossed out because they're not pertinent to the discussion here today. But basically, you can see the at the top was the central government, and they would come up with national standards and national policy statements to guide the regional councils in implementing the RMA. They would also be overseeing that implementation. But the people on the front lines were the local government units, particularly the regional councils. They would come up with regional policy statements, and then they would develop regional plans and implement the regional plans, primarily through the mechanism of resource consents. We'll talk more about that a little later here. There were also a second tier of local government, the district councils and cities, which are somewhat analogous to counties and cities in the U.S. Provisions of the RMA that specifically applied to groundwater include the requirement for a resource consent to take, use, or impound groundwater, and also for discharge of contaminants into groundwater or onto or into land that might contaminate groundwater. There were exceptions having to have a resource consent. You don't need to have a resource consent for reasonable domestic needs, stock watering, or firefighting. And you also don't have to have a resource consent if it's otherwise granted through a national environmental standard or rule in a regional plan. That provision for regulation of water getting consent for a discharge onto or into land that may enter water was a clear definition of what was required there. Unfortunately, our Clean Water Act has been an argument for years as to whether or not the Clean Water Act applies to groundwater, and it's still going on. Anybody getting a resource consent, when they apply, they have to include an assessment of adverse environmental effects, which is referred to as an AEE acronym. Public notice doesn't have to be given. It's discretionary on applications for consents. However, it's supposed to be given if there's a likelihood of adverse environmental effects. The duration of resource consents is specified in the resource consent when it's issued. It can be a maximum of up to 35 years, and a default, if it's not specifically listed, of 5 years. A lot of resource consents now are being, where they used to be issued for 35 years for a municipality water supply, for example, are now being limited to shorter periods, like 5 years, based on caution and a fair amount of overallocation that's occurred in the past, but caution related to changes that might occur with climate change. If you allocate a resource and climate change reduces the resource, you're going to have a problem, and they want to allow time to reconsider that. Central government's main operating arm on environmental matters, including groundwater, is a Ministry for the Environment that was established under the RMA. It has overall responsibility to inform the central government of what's happening, to oversee the regional councils, to provide advice on policies and issues, and generate standards for the regional councils to implement. They also have some what amount to central government override of the regional councils when they deem it's necessary in quote-unquote matters of national significance. So they can come in and take away from the regional boards, regional councils, the decision-making in a resource consent issue. They also can, when they do that, they would typically have a board of inquiry, and they would point a board to review the issue, and the board would then issue the resource consent. There have been a number of problems with implementation of the RMA over the years, and that has led to discussions of RMA reform. 10 years after the RMA was adopted in 2001, a number of the problems that were identified at that time were that many of its provisions were overly bureaucratic, inadequate attention was being given to environmental monitoring, and there had been a lack of national leadership, which has persisted to the point where the central government is supposed to issue national environmental standards and policy statements. And as of this time, after nearly 30 years of the RMA, there's only been one of each that has been issued by the central government. And the national policy statement that was issued was a national policy statement on freshwater management that's been amended and is currently in a state of flux. It's never been issued and just stayed there stable. One of the reasons that water quality has been good in New Zealand in the past are some historical advantages that the country has. There's four main ones that I identify. One is the relatively abundant water resources. When you have places where your annual precipitation might exceed 10 meters, you've got enough water that, you know, the answer to pollution is dilution. That kind of an abundant resource is a lot easier to manage, other than for flood control and erosion. As Jen mentioned, there's basically a rain shadow in New Zealand. Most of the precipitation falls on the west side of the islands, and then on the east side of the islands, there's quite a bit less. And we'll talk more about what that means also. But the other factors were low population density, much lower than in the U.S. or Minnesota, lack of major manufacturing industries, and then a dispersed low-density agricultural production system, which in the past was mainly range-fed beef and sheep, and then forestry. And as most people know, forestry has very little impact on you know, negative impact on groundwater or other water resources. It's if you got a forest, usually your water resources are in pretty good shape. But those factors are changing, particularly with regard to what's called dairy intensification in New Zealand. Dairy intensification has inserted a very high-density major industry with high pollution potential. The lack of central guidance has been an issue. Regional councils have been having to fend for themselves, and some have done a fair job on that, but some have not. And then the projected impact of climate change is a major factor, particularly since some of the areas of potential concern from a water quality standpoint are in the dry parts of the country that are projected to get drier. The dairy intensification issue, you know, New Zealand doesn't produce as much dairy as a lot of other countries. For example, the U.S., we produce much more dairy production. But people in New Zealand are fond of saying that New Zealand punches above its weight. On a worldwide basis, New Zealand is punching above its weight. 95% of New Zealand's dairy production is exported globally, much of it to China. It accounts for close to 30% of the world's global exports of dairy are coming from New Zealand. That makes dairy king in New Zealand. It's the primary industry and a primary source of bringing revenue into the country. What's happened, that dairy intensification has basically got underway since 1990. Over that time frame, the average size of dairy herds has increased from 100 cows to over 400. The number of dairy cows in New Zealand has nearly doubled since 1990. And this is accompanied, oddly enough, by, you know, what a lot of people used to think about New Zealand as being sheep territory. The numbers of sheep are decreasing in millions, tens of millions. And the income generated has increased from $2 billion to over $15 billion. That's a pretty substantial increase in what's happening due to dairy. And the result has been that they've concentrated in limited areas of the country, solid and liquid animal waste, and other impacts from the creation of pastures that are having a serious impact on water quality. This is an illustration of the basic problem. And, some people actually do study this stuff. You've got cows going around with metering devices on their urination. They've got figures on how much volume the average cow urinates and how many times a day, and what the average concentration of ammonia nitrogen is. If you put that all together, a herd of 400 cows would be urinating 94 pounds of ammonia nitrogen per day. And when you measure ammonia nitrogen in milligrams per liter, 94 pounds goes a long way. With one particular proposed development in Canterbury, was for a herd of 80,000 cows. And it was calculated that the waste load from those 80,000 cows would be equivalent to a city size of 400,000. There's only three cities of that size or larger in New Zealand. You know, Wellington and Christchurch are two of them. But when you think of the waste disposal facilities necessary for a city of that size, the costs of providing secondary wastewater treatment, for example, if you weren't able to collect it all in one place. That's a major economic hit. In New Zealand, though, that's all spread out over pasture, although the pastures are much more concentrated than they used to be for beef cattle, for example. Beef cattle in New Zealand were all range-fed, and it provided pretty good beef. I really like New Zealand beef for that factor. To get range-fed beef in the United States, you have to pay a premium. There aren't that many places where it's available. Dairy intensification has resulted in a number of serious impacts in New Zealand. They've cut down tens of thousands of acres of forest to make pastures for dairy herds. This has been accompanied by large increases in fertilizer use, increases of nitrogen fertilizers by over 800%, increase in phosphate fertilizers by over 100% over a 15-year period. Pastoral farming now occupies about 40% of New Zealand's land use. Dairy intensification is occurring on relatively flat, highly fertilized pastures, many of which are alongside streams and in areas of groundwater recharge. As a result, the monitoring that has been done up to date has documented serious declines in water quality, increased sedimentation and nutrient loading primarily, and it's become recognized as a serious national problem, especially in a country that prides itself on its clean green image. This is an example of dairy intensification where a forest was cut down and turned into pasture. You can see the debris from some of the forest. This is an outline of the Canterbury region, ECAN, and you can see from the red triangles in the pasture areas where dairy herds are that nitrate-nitrogen levels have increased statistically significantly between 2003 and 2012. This was the most recent data where this was available. And the highest levels approach 40 milligrams per liter of nitrate-nitrogen. You know, the World Health Standard and the standard we have is 10 for human health protection. Climate change is also a factor. East areas, this is in the Hawke's Bay area and the Canterbury area down to Otago, are where the stream flow is projected to get smaller on the order of 20% in a lot of places, and where you've got the reds over 20%. This is an area where the available water is already over allocated in many places. Also, with climate change, we're anticipating increased incidence of extreme weather events, such as high temperatures, droughts, more winds, and major storm events. All those would have a serious impact on groundwater quality, ultimately. There hasn't been much study of the impact of climate change on groundwater resources in New Zealand. There was one study that I was involved in that GNS performed in 2010 using middle-of-the-road climate change projections. There was a serious decline in warm weather of river streams volumes and less change in groundwater, mainly because the rivers involved in that modeling event didn't go dry. But if they did go dry, which they sometimes do in places, that would more seriously affect the groundwater levels. RMA reform initiatives are underway now. They've been going over the last 10 years. People have been worried about the decrease in water quality and the tension between environmental protection and economic development. Labor drafted a national policy statement, the first one under the RMA, for freshwater management in 2008, but they lost the election before they could implement it. National took over at that point. New national regulations were adopted in 2010 that Labor had initiated, that all water take, surface and groundwater, be measured and reported for all water takes that exceeded 5 liters a second or 79 gallons a minute. In May 2011, the national government had taken over from Labor and it released its policy statement, but it weakened what Labor had proposed. What was issued at that time has been amended several times since then. The last time they reduced the, you know, they put in restriction to public participation, and they introduced a new target to make 90% of New Zealand rivers and lakes swimmable by 2040. A little different than the Clean Water Act, where we want everything to be drinkable and swimmable and fishable. In September 2015, they introduced an Environmental Reporting Act to try and get more data regularly collected and reported, requiring the Ministry for the Environment and Statistics New Zealand to regularly report on the pressure, state, and impacts relating to fresh water. In 2017, the new Labor government took over, and they are calling for a fundamental review of resource management. They intend to repeal what they classified as misguided changes to the RMA made by the national government. And they started a comprehensive review that is expected to take a year to a year and a half, with the objective of getting back the clean rivers that we used to have a couple of decades ago. They intend to, within 1 year, come up with a new policy statements, new national guidelines, and new rules to stop degradation of water quality. I want to run through quickly an example of some of the technical problems that have occurred in New Zealand. This one has to do with groundwater modeling. There are a wide range of competencies of groundwater modelers in New Zealand. Adverse factors about hydrogeology talents in New Zealand are a result of a lot of things, but one of them is there's no tertiary hydrogeology education in New Zealand. So if you need to get an educated, trained hydrogeologist, you have to import them from other countries. That was one of the advantages I had coming from the U.S. That's how I got my job. There are no accepted standards, either professionally or nationally, on how you do things. Particularly, there's no standards that apply to water quality monitoring or groundwater modeling. There are no professional codes. There's no government regulatory agencies. You don't have to be a registered geologist. You don't have to be a registered engineer. And there's very sparse data, particularly for groundwater. This is an area that the Regional Council wants to model. And if you can see where the limited numbers of wells are, this is an area that's 8 kilometers by 8 kilometers in a hilly terrain with lakes and a lot of topography, and you only have a handful of wells there that will give you any data. You know, trying to model that when you can't even calibrate it would be interesting. The example I have is Hawke's Bay Regional Council's groundwater model for the Ruatanifa Plains. This shows where the Ruatanifa Plains are. It's on the dry area. The Regional Council there was both a regulator and a developer, which is somewhat of an obvious conflict of interest. In September 2007, GNS Science offered the Hawke's Bay Regional Council groundwater modeler assistance in constructing a geologic model. The offer was rejected, as that modeler felt that a geologic model wasn't important. And the next year, at that time, 7,000 hectares were being irrigated, mainly with groundwater. The Regional Council decided it wanted to build a dam to supply water to irrigate another 25,000 hectares, primarily for dairy intensification. The Regional Council completed its steady state groundwater model using visual mod flow in 2009. This goes back to the question of the geologic model. The old saying is that some models are, or all models are wrong, but some models are useful. To be useful, I would agree with the British Geological Survey, you have to have a foundation of a good geological model. Regional Council completed its development of a transient groundwater flow model on the same platform the next year in 2010. A report was issued in 2012 indicating that if the dam project went through and dairy intensification happened, it would increase pollution of already polluted streams by 25% for nitrogen and 22% for phosphorus. The Regional Council contracted with GNS, and I was heading up the GNS part of that, to undertake various groundwater modeling scenarios related to the dam proposal using the regional council's flow model. In October, after that contract was signed, we notified the regional council of substantial problems with their model and recommended the model be rebuilt because it was not fit for purpose. That's a buzzword in New Zealand for meanings it doesn't work. The regional council thought about that for a while, and some time went on, and then they decided that instead of rebuilding the model, they'd just cancel our contracts. The GNS review of that groundwater model found a number of errors that we documented in correspondence. We had an eight-page memo, and a number of attachments to it. The first major flaw we saw in the model was that it oversimplified site geology. And I got some cross sections here. How are we doing on time? Okay. You can see that this is sort of a layer cake presentation of geology. Everything looks pretty even. There's a couple of gravel layers on top. And in their model, they said they were, gravel layers were separated by 6 meters of impermeable clay. They said that this material down here was impermeable Miocene, so they didn't have to model below that. And for you in the audience who are geologists, they had Miocene on top of Pliocene, which is unique. This gives you a cross-section of that area out of an authoritative reference on it. It was the only one that existed, so it had to be authoritative. But you can see the bottom part, the HBRC's regional council's groundwater flow model is superimposed on that. And you can see that this superimposed geology doesn't have much of a fit to the geology that was actually there. Apologize for this being blurry. We don't have a superimposition of the model. The model would still have been the same, basically, the three layers they postulated. But you can see that this geology is a lot more challenging than a three-layer layer cake. The second layer of gravel that the model has going all the way across actually only went about 15 or 20% across the cross-section. There were a lot of other problems I think we're not going to have time to talk about. This illustrates one of the ones about the hydraulic conductive zones that they assigned to the model layers. Didn't make any sense. If you take the median value of what they were saying was clay at 0.03 centimeters per second, that had better hydraulic conductivity than the gravel underneath it. And 0.03 is pretty much hydraulic conductivity you might see for medium to coarse sands. Clay would be orders of magnitude below that, 10 to the minus 5, 6, 7. This was a cross-section of their model, and these blue cells down here were rivers. Obviously, there was a problem there. You don't find a river very often on the third layer of a model, third layer of the actual geology. I have found some, though, in karst territory down in Missouri. GNS Legal Counsel, in reviewing the situation about our contracts, decided that we needed to have a disclaimer. We would only do the modeling using the Regional Council's modeling as they insisted if we basically said it wasn't fit for purpose and we had no confidence in the results or the model. I think when they saw that, they accepted that in the contract, but when they saw that in the report, it was when we lost our contracts. I think, the essence of the outcome of that process is that they had a Board of Hearing Inquiry. The board was appointed by the national government, and it was sort of a rigged process because the national government was in favor of building the dam and doing the development. The Board of Inquiry, it was a hotly contested process, a lot of experts, I testified in it. They did issue the resource consent, but they put a rider in it that no one really expected. Let's see. Now, they came out with a dissolved inorganic nitrogen stream quality limit. The regional council had decided that we didn't need that. Okay. Ultimately, that was overturned in court, but it couldn't be overturned on the technical issues because it was a board of inquiry. It was overturned on some legal issues. That went all the way up to the Supreme Court. After having put $20 million into the project, the regional council ultimately dropped the project and sold their remaining interest for $100,000. I had a table on U.S.-New Zealand comparisons. It looks like we're not going to have time to go through that in great detail, but this is just comparing factors related to groundwater management in the U.S. and New Zealand. The first one being aquifer size. We have a range of different aquifer sizes from very small to very large. As Jen pointed out, the Ogallala would be a large one. In New Zealand, they pretty much all classify as small, the biggest one being 5,000 kilometers square. For tertiary education, they just don't have that in New Zealand. People are not getting degrees in hydrogeology. We have world-class university programs here in hydrogeology in the U.S. Standard procedures, we have all kinds of standard procedures, EPA procedures, ASTM procedures. Most states have procedures. The only procedures for groundwater that New Zealand developed were standards for sampling for the NGMP monitoring program. That was done by research conducted in New Zealand in 2006, which sort of has the flavor of reinventing the wheel. We did a lot of research over the decade of the 1980s in that area that could have been used to come up with the same kinds of standards. National laws, we have a plurality of national laws that apply to groundwater. New Zealand has only the RMA. Quantitative standards, we have standards quantitatively for groundwater, for soil that might have water percolating through it that could impact groundwater at state and EPA levels. The only standards that apply to groundwater in New Zealand are drinking water standards. Report writing guidelines, the same thing. There are professional guidelines, academic guidelines, EPA guidelines, state guidelines. There are no guidelines for writing groundwater reports in New Zealand. Monitoring wells, most of ours are purpose-built monitoring wells designed properly and installed, well, hopefully properly, and installed and dedicated to monitoring. In New Zealand, it's mainly farm wells. Age dating is one thing that New Zealand is ahead of us on. We do very little of that in this country. It's widely implemented in New Zealand, and it's a factor for a groundwater drinking water source. You have to get age dated, and it has to be a very small fraction and be of the water classified as being less than 1 year of age. Rainfall recharge lysimeters is another area where New Zealand's relatively ahead of us. They're rare in the U.S. these days. There's a national program for them in New Zealand. Hydrologic research in the U.S., it's integrated by the U.S. Geological Survey, the same agency does surface water and groundwater. In New Zealand, the research institutes are separated. GNS does groundwater, and National Institute for Water and Atmospheric Sciences does surface water. Administrative processes. Most of our laws that apply to groundwater have public participation requirements. It's discretionary in New Zealand. Climate change, we unfortunately lack a national policy. New Zealand has an evolving national policy that's addressing it. Professional codes, there's reasons to look at that more than one way, but we have professional codes, either states or professional organizations, and none of that in New Zealand. The sparse data I mentioned about groundwater modeling, usually when we make a groundwater modeling here, we've got pretty substantial data. In both countries, we often end up reinventing the wheel, but not as much, I think, as they do in New Zealand. And the differences in political systems, it's interesting to think about. In the United States, the states formed a central government. And in New Zealand, the central government formed what amounts to the state governments. And the central government can change that anytime they want. They can do away with the regional councils totally. You'd have quite a problem if the federal government here decided it wanted to do away with one or more of the states. So I apologize for having to go through that so fast at the end, but.
Thank you, Gil and Jennifer. I'm sorry we don't have time for questions, but you'll both be here for lunch, right? Yeah. All right.